Lesson two of toxic relationships and love addiction. Falling in love with unavailable people and the progression of love addiction. Many love addicts find they have a history of falling in love with an unavailable person, and they wonder why this keeps happening over and over again. So the following is a list of the most common reasons love addicts keep falling into this trap. Reminders of our first love. We're always attracted to people who remind us of our first love. If a person's first love was an absent or emotionally unavailable parent, then he or she is only attracted to unavailable people. And this is the only kind of person they pursue. They do this out of habit, despite the pain it will cause them later on. Looking for the happy ending. Many love addicts are not only attracted to unavailable people, they choose them as partners in order to recreate the past and change the ending. They often become obsessed trying to gain through their current partner the love they never got as a child. They do this unconsciously over and over again, and it's a form of insanity. It's their inner child forcing his or her will on them despite the painful consequences. Miscalculations. Many love addicts do not choose an unavailable person. They just fall in love before they find out the person is unavailable. Then, out of stubbornness and because they've become so dependent, they refuse to give up and move on. Unrequited love. Some love addicts can only fall in love with the persons of their dreams. Since no such person really exists, they project their fantasies onto someone and then see in that person only what they want to see. These completely unavailable people are a good target for this kind of projection because the love addict never really gets to know them. They're always who the love addict wants them to be. Love addicts who are also addicted to fantasizing are drawn to the phenomenon of unrequited love. Excitement. Chasing after someone who's unavailable can be exciting. It can really get the adrenaline going, not to mention the libido. Romance addicts often go after unavailable people because they are addicted to the chase. There's an unconscious fear of intimacy. While love addicts consciously obsess about love, they often have an underlying fear of intimacy. And this will be discussed more fully later on. Choosing to fall in love with someone who is unavailable to one degree or another is one way to avoid facing this fear. Dual and cross addiction. Craig Nakin, in his book, The Addictive Personality, Roots, Rituals, and Recovery, presents a strong case for the existence of a personality type underlying all addictions. He explains that the emergence of this personality begins as an escape from emotional pain and then takes on a life of its own as certain chosen rituals take form and become routinely acted out. This means that someone with an addictive personality can become dependent on more than one substance or experience. Whether one believes in the addictive personality or not, it is well documented that addictions often come in clusters. Many alcoholics are also addicted to drugs. Workaholics are known for their obsessive spending. The combination of various addictions are endless. Love addicts have a wide range of subsidiary or dual addictions. Hand in hand with their addiction to love can go an addiction to alcohol, drugs, eating, gambling, working, spending, or sex. These love addicts who are dual addicted have developed other dependencies right along with their obsessions with regard to relationships. These other addictions are unrelated to their addiction to love and have a life of their own. Most love addicts, however, have subsidiary or potential addictions. That is, their obsession only appears when they're having problems with relationships. For instance, some love addicts stop eating when they fall in love and become anorexic, especially if the person they are addicted to likes a slender partner, or they stop eating when a relationship ends because they're depressed. Other love addicts overeat compulsively when things go wrong in their relationship to numb the pain. I've also known love addicts who start drinking or using drugs because their partner is an alcoholic or drug addict, or they may be trying to escape the pain of an unhealthy relationship. Then there are the love addicts who shop compulsively to distract themselves from the pain of a deteriorating relationship, or because they're angry at their partner and want to spend all of his or her money. And some addicts will become workaholics to support their partners or to numb the pain of their addictive relationship. The danger of subsidiary addictions is that they don't always stay that way. They have a tendency to progress even if they come and go, and eventually they can reach a stage of being progression. Obsessing about a person or relationship is symptomatic of an addiction. To clarify this point further, let me explain how the addiction process works. It all begins with what seems like an innocent attraction to someone, which quickly turns into an infatuation, idealizing someone you don't even know, and you don't know them very well. The potential love addict who is insecure and hungry for love takes this infatuation much too seriously and easily becomes blinded by the exhilarating effects of love at first sight. And by blinded, I mean capable of being practical or unable to avoid potentiality, unhealthy situations. Once Cupid has hit the mark, the soon-to-be love addict quickly becomes excessively preoccupied with the loved one. Every aspect of his or her life becomes less important from this new lover, and endless hours are spent fantasizing about how the relationship is going to develop. Of course, to a certain extent, we all go through this when we fall in love. But with the love addict, there is no holding back or common sense. Responsible behavior flies out the window, and everybody and everything takes a backseat to this new relationship. For those who think this is normal behavior, think again. Even if romantic love is blossoming, it is not healthy to turn your life upside down and become a slave to your feelings. At about the point, love addicts will project onto the loved one all of their dreams for eternal happiness via the reinforcing effects of romantic love. And of course, someone who is emotionally secure realizes that one person cannot be totally responsible for a person's happiness. But love addicts who are looking for someone to fix them don't comprehend this idea, and they proceed to pin all their hopes for happiness in this one person. To one degree or another, we all fall victim to the illusion that someone else is responsible for our happiness. But love addicts cling to this idea as if it were a life or death situation. They are totally convinced that their happiness lies in the hands of someone else, and life for them is just an endless search for the holder of their dreams. Once the love addict has projected all of his or her dreams for happiness onto this new lover, unconsciously making a decision that only this person can make him or her happy, the dependency stage of the addiction is triggered. And with it is the love addict's deep-seated fear that the relationship will end, his or her dreams will be smashed. At this point, with so much at stake, a pattern of obsessive behavior emerges. The pattern is designed to ensure that the relationship survives. That is, the love addict will now start trying to control their partner as self-defeating way of holding on. And the particulars will vary with each relationship, but the goal is the same. Hold on at any cost to this person, this relationship, and this dream. This is the stage at which the relationship usually begins to deteriorate. This is because while that love addict is putting forth so much energy to keep the relationship alive, his or partner is usually reacting to this in a negative way. Depending on the individual and the situation, the love addict's partner will now begin to feel smothered, overburdened, intimidated, angry, and ungrateful. And in some cases, he or she will also feel free to become increasingly selfish, demanding, dishonest, neglectful, or abusive, or take advantage of the love addict. Of course, this puts more stress on the relationship, and the love addict tries even harder to hold things together. This further erodes the relationship, and a vicious cycle has begun. The hallmark of an addicted relationship is the fact that the deterioration does not mean the end of the union, because love addicts are dependent. They are hooked on their relationships to keep their dreams of happiness alive. They are far from ready to give up so easily. So instead, they work out an increasingly elaborate network of denial so they can pretend nothing is wrong. This is very sad. Diminishing returns would discourage other people, but a real love addict holds on even tighter. It's sort of like hanging onto the live wire. It hurts, but you can't let go. Eventually, the stress of all this will take its toll, and the love addict's emotional and physical well-being will start to deteriorate along with the relationship. Stress-related disorders become chronic, and other obsessions, food, alcohol, drugs, becomes a tempting way to dull the pain. This is the final stage of the addiction, and often the turning point. This is when a relationship usually explodes or falls apart. Unfortunately, the end of one addictive relationship is not always the end of the love addict's battle with the emotional problem. For many sufferers, the way of relating to others is a pattern in their lives. And when one addictive relationship ends, another just begins. In time, the resiliency of the person who loves addictively will decrease, and their physical and emotional ailments will become life-threatening. They might even die. As Robin Norwood puts it, I want to reiterate that loving too much can kill you. It is the phenomena of dying for love, which particularly validates Halperin's and Peel's assertion that obsessing about a person in the name of love is symptomatic of an addiction. Anybody who holds on to something at the risk of their own life is addicted. So what is the beginning stage? In the beginning stage, the symptoms, love addicts still have their health, as well as a moderate amount of self-respect. And they will not hold on to a relationship too long if their needs are not being met. In the chronic stage, the symptoms of addiction to love are a way of life. Love addicts experience one addictive relationship after another, and stress-related emotional and physical problems have begun to develop. Also, subsidiary addictions will now start to become a problem because the love addict is trying to find ways to take the edge off of his or her emotional pain. Dying for love. As pointed out by Robin Norwood in her book, Women Who Love Too Much, obsessing in a relationship can not only cause physical and emotional problems, it can kill you. Death may come from stress-related disorders, such as heart failure, strokes, ulcers, or from the violence that is often part of an addictive relationship. Death can also come as a result of suicide. So this is the typical progression. Childhood trauma occurs, and excessive hunger for love first appears, low self-esteem begins to develop, a fear of abandonment and loneliness appear, emotional pain becomes apparent, a need for relief increases, mood-altering experiences are used to relieve anxiety, romantic fantasies become a fix, a preoccupation with romance becomes habitual, relationships become a fix, unhealthy dependencies begin to appear, an obsession with someone may occur, addictive thoughts and behaviors become ritualized. The pattern of addiction are repeated and become entrenched. Problems associated with obsession and dependency develop, emotional distress appears, health problems appear, subsidiary addictions continue to progress, addiction to love becomes a problem, the love addict loses control of his or her life, chronic depression sets in. A crisis appears, a life-threatening situation develops, danger is imminent, death or intervention occurs. Origins of love addiction. At this point, you may be asking why some people are so needy and insecure that they get caught up in the devastating effects of an addictive relationship. Where does this insatiable hunger come from? Most experts agree that it is a byproduct of childhood deprivation. But opinions differ as to which type of deprivation does the most damage. Howard Halperin declares that the roots of addiction to love can be traced to what he calls an overwhelming attachment hunger. Halperin explains that attachment hunger is our natural need to attach or bond to someone, a need which stems from our unconscious desire to recreate the euphoric feelings of peace and omnipotence that we experienced as infants when we were totally dependent on our mothers. While most people have normal or typical attachment hunger, which causes little pain and blossoms into a normal desire to become intimate with another human being, some have an overwhelming attachment hunger, which has the power to distort reality and lead to obsessive behavior in relationships. Halperin goes on to say that whether or not a person has an overwhelming attachment hunger depends on how that person's dependency bond with their mother was broken. If a feeling of safety and euphoria were not interrupted and it went into a healthy way of bonding, the child felt secure in their independence and not as if they'd been cut adrift from their life-giving source. If the dependency bond was broken prematurely, insensitively, or sadistically, the child did not have time to adjust, and he or she was left with an overwhelming attachment hunger. As a result, when these children become adults, they feel an especially strong need to bond to someone. They unconsciously equate being in a relationship with survival. They think they will die of loneliness if they're not involved with someone. If this feeling is strong enough, this person will do anything to hold on to someone they have become attached to. They will obsess and they will become addicted. While a traumatic rift in the dependency bond certainly explains why some people so easily turn an attachment or love into an addiction, it does not take into consideration the more ravaging effects of growing up in a dysfunctional home. According to Robin Norwood, this is where the seed of addictive loving are sown. She explains that in a dysfunctional home, a family environment which is not conducive to the mental and physical well-being of the family members, children are neglected or abused over a long period of time and deprived of the kind of attention, strokes, and role modeling they need to become healthy, well-adjusted adults capable of living normally. She makes it clear that children who grow up under these conditions are operating with a handicap and tend to love too much or become addicted to love. Of course, Norwood and Halpern are both right. Attachment hunger and growing up in a dysfunctional home do explain the connection between childhood deprivation and loving addictively. However, I would like to add one more thought to these insights. Many love addicts can trace their neediness and feelings of inadequacy back to those painful years when they were wallflowers. They were bullied or on the outside looking in. And like an overwhelming attachment hunger and growing up in a dysfunctional home, peer rejection and feeling left out can deprive children of the nurturing benefits of acceptance and the natural growth of self-esteem, which could help them become healthy, well-adjusted adults, able to seek and find love in a normal way. With most love addicts, peer rejection is linked to parental deprivation. That is, children growing up in a dysfunctional home might experience peer rejection because other children react negatively to their emotional problems. Very often, children who are unloved at home are emotionally unstable and therefore unsociable, fearful, antagonistic, pushy, too anxious to please. However, in some cases, peer rejection is not linked to problems at home. That is, even if a child does receive parental love in a normal home environment, they still may experience peer rejection because they're shy or self-conscious, disfigured, plain, too bright, overweight, come from a low-income home, have difficulty relating to others, or just don't fit in where they happen to be growing up. Of course, in either case, the impact of peer rejection is relatively the same. It tends to make a child insecure and hungry for acceptance. Few children can escape the after effects and an unhealthy interruption of the dependency bond. The lack of proper parental nurturing or inadequate interactions with their peers. Instead, they grow up lacking in self-esteem and hungry for love. This in turn predisposes them to become love addicts or to become easily obsessed with someone who holds for them the promise of living happily ever after by way of true love. Even when they find out that a kiss never really awakens Sleeping Beauty or turns a frog into a prince. Progress, not perfection. When your body is hurt, it takes a certain amount of time to heal. Every day, if you take care of yourself, you get a little healthier. Recovery from addiction to love also takes a certain amount of time. Depending on the seriousness of the addiction, recovery can take years. This is a bitter disappointment to many recovering love addicts because many of them want to get well overnight or at the very moment they recognize their problem. I call this attitude magical thinking. The idea that our fairy godmother is going to whisk her magic wand and suddenly transform us. Unfortunately, recovery does not happen overnight. It does include some pain. After all, that's why you're here watching this lesson. However, unlike the pain suffered by practicing love addiction, the pain of recovery leads somewhere. It is the pain of growth and it leads to happiness and freedom. Making changes is a process that goes through various stages. For love addicts, the first stage is knowledge or awareness, recognizing their addictive patterns. The next stage is implementing new ways of handling situations. This will happen slowly and require a lot of practice. First, recovering love addicts will notice distorted behavior, thoughts, and values in hindsight, and then they will try to correct those mistakes. Later, they'll start recognizing addictive patterns as they're occurring, but they will still be unable to restrain themselves. Eventually, love addicts are able to put a halt to their addictive patterns in mid-stride, and finally, there will come a time when they see the distorted thoughts and behaviors coming on and finding new ways of handling the situation. And when this happens, a new skill has been learned, a skill which now be practiced and integrated into the recovering love addict's life. This is the beginning of recovery. The temptation to act out addictively is identified and suppressed. Then a new skill is implemented and the recovering love addict becomes stronger. This newfound strength brings on a surge of confidence, which in turn energizes love addicts and makes it easier for them to practice even more self-restraint. In later stages of recovery, non-addictive behavior becomes habitual, and the successful behavior modification contributes to an inner transformation taking place within the recovering love addict. Suddenly, there is a wealth of newly acquired self-respect, which pushes aside the sense of powerlessness. Fears subside, and a sense of happiness and freedom becomes readily apparent. It is as if the recovering love addict has been reborn. Changing not only takes time, recovering love addicts will also go through this process with one issue after another. It's just as soon as they get one addictive behavior under control, there'll be something new to deal with. Therefore, love addicts must be patient with themselves and look for signs of progress, not perfection. Perhaps they have reworked their addictive values with regard to romantic love and relationships, but they may still have trouble changing their addictive behavior. This is progress. Maybe the last time they were addicted to someone, they were abused. Now they get hooked on nice people who just can't make a commitment. This is progress. Maybe it used to be impossible to end an addictive relationship, and now it's just difficult. This is progress, and progress is how recovering love addicts must measure the recovery. Every now and then they must ask themselves if they have made progress. If the answer is yes, they are doing fine. It's important to understand that recovery is not perfect because people are not perfect and no one handles all their personal affairs perfectly. Some people more than others lack the tools they need to be satisfied in their relationships. Therefore, they must honestly evaluate what they are missing and work to develop new skills, which will help them have richer, more fulfilling lives and relationships. They will not, however, do this perfectly or overnight. It is my intention to discourage recovering love addicts by pointing out that getting healthier takes a long time. I just believe it's better to understand how long the process takes and courageously accept this than to give up trying because there's no miraculous recovery. Addiction to love is a powerful and insidious disorder. It springs from childhood trauma that at best can only be transcended, not reversed, and healing takes time. Therefore, I encourage love addicts to be patient with themselves and gather as much support as you can from these lessons and from our tribe. Thank you, and I'll see you in the next lesson.